Hi, this is Julie.
Hello, and this is Scott.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find, where
yes,
two Catholics look at the one reality that we see kind of under everything, I guess.
You bet. You bet. And this is episode number 150. No.
Wow, my memory's so bad.
Episode 5, right?
Yay.
We're going to talk about The Franchise Affair by Josephine Tay.
Yes, and this is an author who I'm always surprised more people don't know.
And I had not heard of her till you put this book on our list. So she wrote this book in 1949, so she was active right around in there, right?
Yep. She only wrote, 8 mysteries, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
She died young, but it's generally agreed that her writing was just brilliant, because her mysteries were generally different from each other. And this book, it was a toss-up between this and one that other people may have heard of more, which is called The Daughter of Time. But I reread The Franchise Affair recently, and as happens, when you look at something with a new perspective, or from just being older, I was so surprised at some of the themes here that I saw as being even more important now than they were in 1949, and I was surprised at how long ago this was written that I chose this one.
Mm-hmm.
And shall I summarize it?
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that. Yeah, I was going to agree with you, because there are some things in here that apply to today so incredibly well that I can't wait to talk about them.
I know, you can't decide if she was prescient or if it's really true that people are people and things don't change as much as we think.
Right, right.
Maybe both. the plot is told from the point of view of Robert Blair, who's a lawyer in a little tiny town where nothing different ever happens. And he's getting ready to leave for the day, and he gets a phone call from a local woman named Marion Sharp, who lives with her mother out at some old country manor, and they're kind of known as being kind of odd birds. No one knows much about them, and they don't really fit in. And what he finds out is she says, "Scotland Yard's here." He's like, "What?" So he goes out, and they have been accused of kidnapping a young girl and holding her captive to do their housekeeping and cooking, because they can't keep anyone, of savagely beating her, treating her like a slave, and she finally escapes and goes to the police about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so she seems to have incontrovertible proof of all this, and they say it's absolutely not true. But how do you fight an accusation like that?
Yeah.
And then what it goes from being a quiet kind of a private case to being a national publicity case when a tabloid gets a hold of it and starts publicizing this innocent young girl's plight.
Right.
Yeah.
And the masses of people make their lives extremely difficult because they make their decisions based on what was in the paper. And
yes.
They start to react to it, and it makes it very difficult for these two women to live, even though they haven't been really officially accused of anything for a long while in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Or, certainly not proven guilty in any way.
And it also makes it seem odd as to why other evidence isn't coming up to show that this girl may not have been there, and the lawyer is trying everything. And this is not really his area of expertise at all, but he's determined he's going to prove that they haven't done it, because he just feels that they haven't. So that's kind of the brilliance of this, is every time something turns up that looks like it may exonerate them, it's shown to be either substantial or a new piece of evidence shows up for the other side. And so to the very end, you are kept wondering what is going to show up, because you also are believing with him that these women are innocent, because that's the point of view the book is being told from.
Right. Yeah, the victim, or the supposed victim, because we don't know anything until pretty darn near the very end, is not the focus of the book. In fact, we don't see her very often at all. just when she comes into contact with this lawyer.
And every time we do, he's continually surprised because she is so innocent seeming, sweet, youthful, honest. She comes across just as you would believe her. I mean, just the person on the street that you would believe. And so it's interesting to see that here and there, you'll find people who don't believe her.
Yeah.
But it's few and far between, and it's always based on previous experience and not on her herself, because he will have built up in his mind some vicious person because based on what he knows or what he thinks has happened. And then he's like, oh, wait, she really is sweet looking. And wow, my doubt is shaken.
Yeah, yeah. And at the same time, the two women that he's dealing with, Marion Sharp and her mom, he's convinced that they're innocent. You know, pretty much from the first time he meets them, he's just continually thinking, well, there's just no way that this is true. There's just no way. And throughout the book, that's his perspective. And then every now and then this victim comes into the picture and he's like, well, I don't sure now.
Yeah.
But he feels bad for doubting, and because he gets to know the women pretty well.
Yeah, it's really, you're put in the kind of case that it's very real, I think, because you can understand how he feels. It's the kind of thing that when you read about something in the paper and you think, oh, well, that must have happened this way. And then you meet somebody who knows more about it, or you see somebody else on TV from the other side and you go, well, wait a minute, I can't tell.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very real that way. And the fact that he's so out of his depth and he's having to try to find any friend he can or resource to help him. So he's very grateful anytime somebody doesn't believe her.
Right. And he's enlisting help wherever he can. And excuse me. And he's doing it for free because the ladies he's dealing with, they don't have any money, and he knows that. And at first you don't really understand why he's doing what he's doing, but you know, one of the first things that struck me about the book, because it was so early, was, you know, how many little pieces of human nature are just littered throughout this. You know, well, she's just throw a sentence in there. You should see my paperback book. I've got like post-its. Probably every 10 pages there's a post-it. You know,
I also have little markers all over the place.
Yeah. So when she called him initially, he was just at work and he was getting his tea. He was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, and every day at 3 o'clock, this lady would bring in the tea. And he was just thinking, you know, this is really as far as I'm going to go. Yeah. And then the phone rings. And there was a sentence, something along the lines of, you know, if this call had come in just a few minutes later, I'd have been gone. And none of this stuff would have happened to me.
Yeah.
So he was feeling pretty much, you know, in the routine, starting to feel a little bit sad that, hey, this may be all that my life has to offer. So I think a lot of his motivation, at least initially, was, hey, this is kind of exciting.
Well, that, and it's a funny thing because, again, it's that sense of human nature. He's always fighting against himself. He's always going, I don't want to do this stuff. This is difficult. It's annoying. And yet at the same time, he does.
Yeah.
And then he becomes attracted to Marion Sharp. So then he gradually kind of turns himself into a knight errant because he wants to do it for her.
Right.
Yeah. And she's not asking him to. She and her mother both understand why people wouldn't believe them.
Yeah.
It's frustrating.
But they want this particular guy to believe him in the worst way.
Yeah.
Yeah, now the mother is pretty much hilarious. She's out there.
But, she's a character.
But to Marion, it was important that he believe her. And whenever she'd come up with something, she'd call him immediately and say, you know, what about this? You know, and, you know, she was always pleased when he believed what she was saying, which he always did. He never didn't.
Mm-hmm.
He never completely was taken by the victim, you know, as far as belief goes.
Right. Well, and then you start to see the people that his life is surrounded by. And these also are types that we recognize. He's got the nephew, because this is a firm that has been around for a very long time. So,
yeah. And what he does is things like wills. That's what he's good at. And when she calls him, he's like, you need somebody else. You don't need me. you need this other guy because I don't do this. If you need a will, then you call me.
Yeah, but, she's like, oh, please don't make me use that horrible man in the little spotted suit or checked suit or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Who, funnily enough, he does meet him and talk to him toward the end of the book or the middle of the book. And he's extremely sharp. He immediately has pegged that they probably didn't do it, but how are you going to prove it? And he's got some good insights to that kind of thing. And he might even be the person who recommended the detective. I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't recall for sure that either, but yeah, he was important.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, and Marion, you know, she would judge people by how they look. So she connected to Robert because, you know, hey, you know, you look like the kind of guy that I need.
Yeah.
And that was all that she knew. Yeah.
We all do it. And that's, also it's kind of interesting because that kind of goes along with the young girl, Betty Kane, who, you know, he knows what he thinks she's like, and then he sees her and he's shaken.
Mm-hmm.
There's this difference between how do you look and how are you acting?
Right.
Or how do I think you're acting? And I like the fact, to me, early on, there's something that kind of said that this book was double-layered, and it was just a little thing. And plus, I love words. So he says, he's walking somewhere, and it says, round in Sin Lane, he ran into the usual war but extricated himself. Etymologists, in case you're interested, say that the sin is merely a corruption of sand. But the inhabitants of Milford, of course, know better. Before those council houses were built on the low meadows behind the town, the lane led direct to the Lover's Walk in High Wood. It's that. The experts all know this, but the locals, the common sense all tells you that.
Right, right.
You know, we all know what's really gone on there. So, and the whole thing is full of that, as you point out, the little bits of human nature, what you know, what you think you don't know, and we can relate to them because she's using examples and characters that we recognize, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So when she doesn't do that, you're kind of surprised. Like when Robert goes to meet Betty's mother, because he's looking for any kind of evidence from the story. This is early on that might give him a clue as to how to look for something. And he expects somebody who's been taken in, who's, you know, wants to believe the best. And what he finds is a young woman who used to be a school teacher and understands what kids are like. And she sees her daughter fairly clearly.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, she's kind of greedy. She'll do anything for food. And she's like this. She goes, but she didn't do this. This is true.
Mm-hmm.
And that really shakes him because he's like, wow, you're a person I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, and that kind of happened over and over, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, throughout, it depend, you know, whoever he was talking to, whether it be a shopkeeper or the bartender. Somebody that he knew, you know, a bartender and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Or even the brother, because the reason the story gets leaked to the tabloids, the family doesn't want that to happen, but she's got a brother who's older and who, you know, just loves his sister, and he's mad because he thinks justice is not being done, people aren't prosecuting properly.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes and tells the news, and he meets the brother, and you're expecting, because he is, this pompous young jerk who, you know, thinks he knows better, and what he meets is a kind of pretty nice boy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's indignant on his sister's behalf, but he's not a bad guy.
Right, right.
Which is what you've been led to believe he could be.
Yeah. Another interesting thing about it to me was how things occurred in the book.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when he was talking to the victim's mom, and it occurred to him suddenly to ask one question as he was leaving.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting how, you know, he explained that to himself, whether, you know, he didn't know where the question came from, but he just said, it just suddenly occurred to him as he was leaving, did she have anything in her pockets when she came home? And there was an answer to that question that helped him understand something. So, but.
And more than that, the troubled look on the mother's face, because she couldn't quite make that fit.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow.
Right. And there is a lot of prayer and things in this book too. Especially towards the end, but where everybody's praying for, you know, hey, we need this, you know, and there's not prayer specifically. They just say, you know, I was praying for this, and, you know, thank God it arrived.
As an expression of speech. But the kind of one of the funny things I thought, well, for one thing, as I think I mentioned this, I can't remember if I told you this before we started recording, but I had read all of Josephine Tay's books several times when I was in high school and college because my parents had a complete set. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you read something that many times and you think, well, I know the whole thing. And I picked it up fairly recently and reread it. And I was so stunned at some of these themes that that's when I said, oh. And one of these was the continual emphasis on the ultimate triumph of good, the power of prayer, that miracles really do happen. And the funny thing, when I was thinking about it this morning, is that these come from one of the most unlikely sources, which is Robert's Aunt Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
He lives, you get a picture early on, excuse me, of his Aunt Lynn, who's this, I kind of think of Aunt B on the Andy Griffith Show.
Sure. Uh-huh.
A comfortable kind of, you know, nice little lady. Nothing bad ever happens in her world. She's very one of the early people to believe the news and say, oh, why are you representing those women?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they probably did it because the paper says so.
Right.
And but she also trusts him that late in the book when he says, no, things aren't going well. And she goes, oh, my goodness. Well, why didn't you tell me? I'm going to skip going to this event and I'm going to go spend an hour at the church praying for them. And he says, oh, come on, Aunt Lynn. And she's like, oh, now don't you talk to me that way. This prayer is important.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's not working, she's like, what? Okay, well, then I'm going to go back and pray some more. And I'm going to ask for a miracle. And do you mind if I read this?
No, go right ahead. Please do. Yep.
Okay. And she says, plus, it's probably going to rain at this garden party anyway. I might as well go to the church and pray. And he says, well, Aunt Lynn, I don't deny we need your prayers. Nothing short of a miracle can save us now. Well, I shall pray for the miracle. A last-minute reprieve with the rope around the hero's neck? That happens only in detective stories and the last few minutes of horse operas. Not at all. It happens every day, everywhere in the world. If there was some way of finding out and adding up the times it happens, you would no doubt be surprised. Providence does take a hand, you know, when other methods fail. You haven't enough faith, my dear, as I have pointed out before. I don't believe that an angel of the Lord is going to appear in my office on account of what Betty Kane was doing for that month, if that is what you mean, Robert said. The trouble with you, dear, is that you think of an angel of the Lord as a creature with wings, whereas he is probably a scruffy little man in a bowler hat. Anyhow, I shall pray very hard this afternoon and tonight, too, of course, and by tomorrow perhaps help will be sent.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's all you know, you would think the whole book's like that, and that's just really, it's such an inconsequential part of it. It's almost just tossed in there that it's really not like that. That's the first time that kind of thing comes up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But it turns out to be an important underlying thread. As you said, when he said, I don't know what made me stop and ask about her pocket of all things.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. So it's just, yeah, things like that occurred. And, you know, I think that that's the reason, you know, it's providence is what, as she was saying.
Yeah, and everybody has to take a hand and work as hard as they possibly can, but it's, excuse me, but they're also sometimes just responding to, you know, what has all kinds of different names, instinct, just a hunch,
mm-hmm.
just something that pops into your head, or, you know, Aunt Lynn's prayers.
Right, right.
Which is funny because she's also sending up other characters like their housemaid. Ernestine, is that her name?
She just makes me laugh, that lady.
Well, no, she's not meant for, I don't think she's meant for anything other than to go, here's how most people think of religion, I think.
Uh-huh, yep.
Because she's, you know, they said, oh, she sings hymns every day while she does her housework. And they'll say, what's wrong with her? Oh, she's being saved. She's going to a new church. She's getting ready to tell us what sinners we are again soon.
Yeah, they made it sound like, you know, warlike. Here she goes again. You know, this is a different church for her. She decided that these people were this. So now she's doing that.
It's funny.
It is really funny. Yeah.
Do we want to talk about spoilers yet or do we want
Yeah, let's go ahead and jump in.
Okay.
So yeah, this is the point, folks, where if you want to read this book without us spoiling it, hit pause right here, and we'll talk to you later.
Yes.
All right. Okay. We're done.
Yeah. Okay. Now, let's see. I'm not sure if there's anything specific I wanted to say.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I wanted to make sure that we talked about, to me, it is such a huge part of this, mm-hmm. was that tabloid newspaper.
Which now, is why I picked this book, actually.
Is it really? Okay. But the, you know, I'm sitting here flipping through the book. I have way too many post-it notes in here.
I'm the same way.
I want to find this one specific part. Now what happened with the case, you know, the initial case happens where the girl goes to Scotland Yard or the police and she accuses the women. But a week passes after that initial time and nothing really occurs because the police have no way. It's just she said. There's really no way for them to make any determination on who is telling the truth.
Yeah.
But what blows this up is a news story that gets put in the local tabloid newspaper. It has a picture of the teenage girl on the front. You know, she's 15 or 16 years old, looking very pretty and everything. And then they write the story in a way that makes it pretty darn clear that the women that live at the franchise, I don't know if we've said that, that the name of their house is the franchise.
Right.
So the women that live at the franchise are guilty.
Yeah.
And the entire town, I guess it's a town, right? The entire town where this tabloid newspaper is circulated turns on the women. They're saying, yeah, if the newspaper said this, it's true.
Well, actually, also in England, I will just say this about tabloids. Mm-hmm. Most of their national papers, like, you know, we would say, what, the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or the New York Times that can get distributed nationally, they are tabloids.
Okay.
Very few of them are not tabloids. And because my husband lived there for a while, and he said, yes, you could open up the national paper and there's this, you know, girl in a bikini in the middle spread because that's what sells. So the paper, I got the impression that the paper was actually one of these national tabloids. So their name was splattered across the country.
Through the whole country. Okay.
Yeah. So it was even worse because they're like, oh, they're the local bad, awful people.
Uh-huh.
You know, so the town felt even more strongly about it.
Right, right. So, yeah, it was like there.
Because it's a more important paper.
Yeah, there it was, you know, this is happening in our place. You know, that was said one time during the trial at the end. They all showed up and somebody noted, you know, where are all these people coming from? You know, don't they have jobs and things? And they said, well, you know, this is important stuff. This is our own thing here. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
we're important on the national scene now.
Right.
Yeah. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted you.
No. So what I'm doing, I'm looking, you know, unfortunately I should have marked this more clearly, but I'm looking for a place where, after that initial week where the initial newspaper came out, the second week had letters to the editor in it. Oh. And that's the part that I'm looking at because, to me, it was describing the internet. You know, she wrote this book in 1949, and I was just blown away by what I read, and I really wanted to read it.
Well, while you're looking for that, let me read the little bit that struck me about that same thing where he talks about, because to me, I didn't think about the internet as much, although that's an excellent point. What I was thinking about was the way the national media just grabs a little bit of something, throws it out there, and then never covers it again.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that someone's been exonerated. You don't know that something else has happened. They just leave it and go to the next thing. And it's always the worst aspect. And he says he's looking at this because he's never really looked at one of these tabloids because, ugh. And he says, it must be a dreary business catering exclusively for the human failings. He turned the pages over, observing how consistently each story was used to appeal to the regrettable in the reader. Even Gave Away a Million, he noted, was the story of a disgraceful old man unloading on his income tax and not of a boy who had climbed out of a slum by his own courage and enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a lot of the extreme negativity that you see in the main media. And, of course, there are shows that are dedicated to it. There's one that's yeah. you know, like some entertainment show where they just sit around and they look like the biggest bunch of losers ever. And they just slam on celebrities for one thing or another. And I'm like, have you guys looked in a mirror? Come on. Do you hear what you're saying?
Yeah.
The
yeah,
worse.
Right.
But,
yeah, I did find that part.
Okay, great. Okay.
So, again, the initial story came out 1 week, and the next week's version of the paper has people's responses to that. He says, threading his way out of the Larborough traffic, the silly phrases came back to him, and he marveled all over again at the venom that these unknown women had roused in the writers' minds. Rage and hatred spilled over onto the paper. Malice ran unchecked through the largely illiterate sentences. It was an amazing exhibition. And one of the oddities of it was that the dearest wish of so many of these indignant protesters against violence was to flog the said women within an inch of their lives. Those who did not want to flog the women wanted to reform the police. One writer suggested that a fund should be opened for the poor young victim of police inefficiency and bias. Another suggested that every man of goodwill should write to his member of parliament about it and make their lives a misery until something was done about this miscarriage of justice. Still another asked if anyone had noticed Betty Kane's marked resemblance to the Saint Bernadette. Isn't right. that, I mean...
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I know that I've said this on here before, you know, but if you're worried about the state of our society, just go look at a YouTube video and look at the comments under it.
Yeah.
But what struck me about the whole tabloid issue is something that worries me all the time. And it's why I'm always uneasy talking about politics, current events. Because, and the main reason is because I don't know that I have the truth of what occurred. And I mm-hmm. don't know that we're getting the truth of what occurred. If, you know, you can find a channel or a blog or something to read or watch that is from your point of view already. And, you know, you can get it confirmed or you can get that view denied. You can find what you want to find in the news. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like these people that wrote these letters to the editor in the tabloid, I mean, the internet is just full of people who are absolutely certain that they've got the truth and they're, you know, railing on and on about it. And, you know, but they can't all be right, you know. You can find people that are just as sure that they've got it as anybody else. And I think that that's a huge problem for our society yeah. and the world is that, you know, we're not dealing with facts all the time. We're dealing with opinions.
Nobody is inclined, and I'll fall into this and I have to pull myself back out, but nobody's inclined to give their opinion charitably.
Mm-hmm. And that's true too. You know, yeah.
It's if all these things were said with a spirit of charity, meaning, you know, the possibility that you're wrong, the possibility that even if somebody like, you know, even if these ladies did this, that, well, let's, you know, let's hope for the best. Let's hope they didn't do it. But if they did, you know, kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
nobody's willing to give the benefit of a doubt to anyone. And,
yeah, we don't have a news source, which is just facts.
And I don't think we ever do.
Yeah, I think that we were closer to that in the past than we are now.
Yeah, 1949?
Yeah,
that's what exactly. I would have said until I read this.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm the same way. Maybe not, but yeah, and maybe that is a miss. You know, maybe I'm wrong on that, but it appeared to me that journalists used to be, let's get people the facts, and we're not going to prejudge these facts. We're going to just report them, you know? Mm-hmm. So if you had a journalism student, their goal wasn't to change the world. Their goal was to get people information. Whereas right. now I would assume, or my impression is that the average journalism student wants to save the world. You know, that they're thinking, okay, well, right. this is extremely good for the world. That's why I need to be a journalist.
Right. They have an agenda
right.
instead of just finding facts.
Exactly. And but I can't think of a single news source in which that is, you know, in the United States, you know, which is where I live, of course, there. Right. I can choose whether I want conservative slanting stuff or liberal slanting stuff mm-hmm. or economic slanting stuff. You know, I can choose what type of news I want.
Yeah.
And as a Catholic, too. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm interrupting.
No, go
but,
ahead.
But
no.
as a Catholic, I have learned over the last 4 years especially that when I see a news story that has something to do with the Pope or the Catholic Church,
yeah.
that I am not to believe that news story for at least 2 weeks. And within 2 weeks, what really happened or what really was said or what a letter really contained is going to come out. And the negative part about that is, you know, some papers are not going to print what really happened, mm-hmm. but it's just the initial shock or consternation or how whatever word you want to use, they give yeah. you that, but then they don't give you the follow-up where, this is what really occurred. Here's the facts of what happened.
They don't even give both sides. Like, say mm-hmm. long time ago to me right now, the Pope did that speech where he talked about Islam
mm-hmm.
or Muslims, and he was doing it in the middle of an extremely intellectual paper about, you know, and he was talking about, I quoted past history, blah, blah, blah. And all that happened was the most inflammatory words they could think of got snatched out, put in headlines. Did anybody bother to say, and here's the context? You could go read the speech about a few days later. It was put up for everyone to read. Did anybody go do it? Well, a few sources, you know, some Catholic blogs, some things like that. But nobody ever went back and corrected any of that. Nobody went back where the Pope went, okay, I was new to the Pope business and I should have known better, but I really thought people would look at this in the context it was given in.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just one example. There are many more.
Yeah, and as far as, you know, Catholicness goes, I think that there's a lot of people reporting on the Catholic Church who I don't know that it's specifically some kind of an agenda, but mm-hmm. I know that they're not religious folks. And I don't know that they're trying to, you know, chop it down like a tree, but all I know is that they don't understand. And when you read a news story, you're like, well, this person really has no clue what they're talking about. You know, maybe they're earnestly trying to report the facts, and that could be, but they have no clue. They have no context whatsoever. So when they write something, they completely don't understand what they're writing about. And, people. Yeah. I still meet people that, you know, when you talk to them as a Catholic that, you know, are surprised by some of the views of the Catholic Church because they believe that, you know, everybody's a fundamentalist Christian. You know, that there's nothing but fundamentalist Christians out there that, you know, believe that we shouldn't teach things in schools and on all this stuff. You know, well, if you're a Christian, you obviously believe everything like that. And anyway, it's disturbing.
They've been taught about the Catholic Church. They've been taught things like you worship the Pope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, worship Mary. That's a really good one. Yeah, right.
You know, and the thing is that they don't stop to even ask the question. They kind of just go on the attack. It's kind of funny that way
mm-hmm.
because the information's out there, but a lot of people just go based on what I know, which I think is what I liked about the book in terms of, they're the masses, and they go based on what everybody knows. And if everybody knows it, it must be true. And mm-hmm. this shows from the few characters who will think for themselves and go based on past example or their own experience or a wider view, what does it take to stand up to popular opinion? What are you risking when you do that?
Yeah.
People who guard their house are risking their life and limb for a principle of innocent until proven guilty and not going with mob rule.
Right. And Robert Blair in this book, he could very well have walked away. In fact, I recall, didn't Marion kind of tell him, hey, you know, we understand if you want to leave.
Yes.
But, he said, no, you know, this isn't right. What's going on here. And it was a very difficult thing because it got harder and harder for those women to stay at their house. And the police, you know, they would send somebody by now and then, you know, to get whoever gathered around outside. You know, you got to picture this is a house that's off the road and it's gated. So, you know, people would gather around outside. Somebody painted on their wall out front. I forget what they painted exactly, but
something stupid. Yes, I think
it was something stupid for sure.
The fact they weren't educated or something. Yeah,
exactly. And but it got more and more difficult, and all based on what this newspaper had to say. You know, and then somebody said, "Well, it's in the paper. It's in the paper, so it must be right."
Yeah.
And I don't know that we have that. Maybe we have that less now as a culture, where people are less apt, maybe, to believe something that's in a paper. I'm not sure.
I don't know, though, because think about when you talk about the internet, I'm thinking about the guy who, in Texas, we remember it maybe more immediately, the guy who flew his plane into the local IRS building in Austin. Oh,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. The tax building for people who aren't in America, maybe, who might listen. And it was because he felt that he'd been cheated. Well, you look at everything and go, he was delusional, okay? He owed taxes and then didn't feel like he wanted to pay them. But what happened is he would post things on his blog and all these people would pile in and agree with him and support him. Mm. And I think some of the feeling was that if he hadn't had all that support, he might have just continued being a crank. One of those people who writes letters and does whatever. But no, he took action. He felt that he was being a martyr to the cause, and he killed people over it, including himself. But I mean, there were innocent people who were just doing their job that died because he had vitriolic hate stuff supporting him.
Yeah, yeah.
And so those cases aren't frequent, but they're frequent enough that you think, you know, if people are going, well, now let's look at both sides of it, or just not responding.
Right.
Then, and I realize that's an extreme case, but, and I look at what people say and spread, like when you're talking about the Catholic faith, there's a podcast I used to really like to listen to, and I knew the guys were pretty opinionated. And at one point they had been on a podcast highlight on my own blog or on my own podcast a long time ago. And then they did a episode about, oh, let's see, they called it so charmingly why Mother Teresa was a douche. I'm like, oh, okay, they've read Christopher Hitchens' book, I see.
Oh boy.
Well, you can agree with that or you can not agree with it. You can try to take it in perspective and look at it from a different point of view. He's not really a lover of people who are religious anyway. But the first thing they did was start off by saying, well, you know, I'm not a Christian. Those people, they just take these books that were written so long after Jesus died and they just believe them like they're true. And I'm like, I'm going, okay, first of all, could you not show your own ignorance and insult me at the same time? Because how about the first of those books that, you know, like what Paul wrote and the first of the Gospels were written within 30 years of his death, of Jesus's death. Show me a book about Alexander the Great that's taken as, so to say, gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, some of these great people from the past that we all take as being really true. A lot of them were written hundreds of years later.
Right, right.
But, you know, nobody even goes into a qualifier like that. And so these guys may or may not have many people listening to them. I don't know. But that gets spread out there. And that's one more source of I just want to spread what I think out there. Because everybody knows it's true.
Yeah.
Let's go on.
And there is a whole lot of because everybody knows it's true going on out there.
Yeah.
There is no doubt about that. Yeah.
I run into that a lot. And it's frustrating to me more when it's Catholics.
Yeah. Yeah.
They come to you and I understand, you know, a lot of things like to get blamed on. There's a lack of what Catholics would call catechesis, which is teaching, you know, teaching of the catechism, which is kind of like, as I told somebody, it's like the official rule book explaining here's what we think and practice and here's why. But people don't even pick up anything to say, why is this? They just go with, well, popular opinion says this and it's stupid. So I'm going to, you know, say that about my own faith and make fun of it.
Yep.
Which is very annoying.
Yeah, it is very annoying. So, yep. So when you hear something about the Pope, just give it a couple weeks.
Yeah. Or what everybody knows that Catholics do, find a Catholic and ask them. Or,
yeah.
Write to Scott and me.
For sure.
We'll find it out.
I will do my best to give you the right answer.
Yeah, we might not know it right off the top of our heads, but we'll find out for you. Ask a Catholic you trust. Why does the church teach something?
Mm-hmm.
So
You bet. So, and back to the book. Let's see. Another thing, back to the miracle aspect.
Yeah.
Now, we're in spoiler territory, so I'm about to throw some stuff out here again. So here's a second bonus warning. But the angel of the Lord was not a scruffy little man, as it turned out. And his hat was a regrettably continental affair of felt and with a tightly rolled brim turned up all round. He arrived at Blair, Hayward, and Bennett's about 11:30 the following morning.
That's the very next morning.
Yeah, I just love it. And, that's how things, they happen in life. I don't know if I'm a big Castle fan. I don't know if you watch that show Castle.
I do. I love it.
Absolutely love that show.
Yeah, me too.
And there are things that happen. Sometimes it's impossible to figure out, who did it. And the reason is because, you're missing some vital piece of information. And, I am not a huge mystery reader. So I don't know what's typical, but in this book, and we talked about it, when we talked about The Stand. I know we didn't talk about The Stand totally, but remember how God had his hand in The Stand.
Right.
And how I was wondering, how do people react to this? So as you're watching a mystery in Castle, and I would say that Castle, by the way, is this type of a book or a show. It's similar to this book in the way that it's laid out, and there's this mystery that's going on, and they're looking for clues, and then every now and then something, they get a breakthrough moment, and then maybe the breakthrough wasn't the big breakthrough that they thought it was. That's the same thing, and here this was written in 1949. Right. So,
but they never attribute them to miracles. They never do.
But
touched by an angel solves mysteries or anything.
Sure. Yeah. And this isn't either, really.
No, it isn't.
But all they're just saying, hey, this is kind of miraculous how this guy showed up at exactly the right time. But I guess my point is that happens in Castle, where you can't solve the mystery based on the information you have, and then all of a sudden something from left field comes in, and you may have an additional person that you didn't know about. Mm-hmm. Or something that, there's no way that you could have thought of this, 10 minutes ago during that show.
Right.
But that kind of occurs here. They're praying. They're saying, gosh, we need something so badly. We know that you're innocent, but we can't prove it. There's nothing that we can do. And I've run out of options.
Mm-hmm.
And then they revert to prayer. And, then this fella shows up.
Which Robert doesn't believe in anyway. So.
Right. And Robert, yeah, exactly. That's important to note as well. Yeah, Robert is not, on his knees praying. but other people in the book are. And, in walks this person. And that, it wasn't an implausible thing to me at all. And I just don't know how readers who don't feel that that's a valid option, how they feel about things like that when they happen in a book. Like I said about The Stand, I know that a lot of people complained about God's action in The Stand, saying, Stephen King copped out, and he ran out of ideas, and he did that. But to me, it was just like perfect. I mean, it was right on. This is just terrific.
I can tell you, in this book, mm-hmm. I remembered it so fondly, but that didn't stand out to me. And remember, I've been, my Catholic birthday, which is Easter, will come up as the 11th one this Easter. So 2000 is the year I became Catholic. So I knew and loved this book and didn't even remember that as being a big aspect. My parents have the books, knew them, loved them, atheists.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what this shows is that used to be a much more common way of thinking and writing, and it doesn't stand out as much when you're reading it unless you've got that focus on it like we did, because we're reading it for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's kind of a surprise to find it a regular mystery. It's part of Aunt Lynn's character. It's part of the miraculous nature of it, the fact that there's no hope. And think of how the guy, he's He's Danish. He runs a hotel. He only happened to see the picture in the paper because something was wrapped in newspaper, I think, that he unwrapped and saw and said, oh, I'd better go over there. This is a big case. You know, someone translated it for him or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a truly miraculous chain of happenstance, let's say.
Right.
And so it was very easy for Robert to go, holy moly, it's the miracle. You don't have to believe it. I mean, I didn't ever go, oh, this is what a cop-out. I mean, the fact is that these things happen in the book. If you want to get mad because the character attributes it, they don't go around going, and it's a miracle, and it's a miracle. I mean, he tells Aunt Lynn, your miracle showed up. And she goes, oh, did it, dear? That's nice. You know, just like, I expected it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of makes me... Yeah, how do you feel in real life?
Well,
you know, with
I was
going to
say, you know, I had a big post, and I felt so stupid for this very reason, because I know how people look at this, about last Friday when Hannah's dog got out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this sounds like no big deal, except this dog is a rescue dog that when it was x-rayed, it shows that it was abused so much that it has like 75 birdshot under its skin.
Wow.
It's. I've been feeding it raw hamburger and chicken for about 3 months now. It will just now get to the point where it will come up to me at the dinner table when I can't get up fast and let me rub behind its ears. Mm-hmm. It's very shy. Hannah's the only one it loves. Mm-hmm. And it got out and Hannah wasn't home. I was like, oh, please, God, please, please. I know you don't work like this, but send this dog back. Let me look in the right place. Oh, he's never going to come to me. And I called Hannah. Hannah just happened to be about 15 minutes from the house on her way home. Mm-hmm. I called Tom, who dropped everything. He only works 5 minutes away. And we all started combing the neighborhood. And this is a dog that took the entire volunteer fire department of a little town named Garrett, Texas, to catch it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he won't even let us near him in the backyard. Hannah's the one who has to put a leash on him because he trusts her.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, this dog is going to take off. We're never going to see it again. It's mostly pit bull. Some fine homeowner who has a gun in Texas is going to go, oh, it's near my baby. I'm going to kill it. Oh, what are we going to do? And just so happens that about 40 minutes later, and I mean, I had given up being nice and praying by that point. I was kind of going, okay, look, God, you don't ignore the sparrows. I am telling you, you better take care of this little dog.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you threaten God, it's never nice, but mm-hmm. luckily he understands. But all of us happen to be converging on exactly the same corner in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And that's not that big a deal. But after 40 minutes, you would expect this dog to be much further away.
Sure.
And Tom, at the point he started coming out of the bushes and he was looking for the house too. He's like, oh, freedom, horrible, horrible freedom. He was going from door to door trying to find the house.
Oh.
Yeah, very slowly. And Tom got out and said something. And so he dove into the bushes and he called Hannah, who had just gone down the alley there and turned around and 1 minute later was there. Mm-hmm. They called me. I was 1 minute away heading for the very same corner. And I'm like, yes, that's coincidence. Yes, it's in our neighborhood. But you know what? Maybe not Tom. Mm-hmm. But Hannah and I were barraging heaven on behalf of this little dog because we were positive we were never going to see him again. Mm-hmm. Unless it was to say, oh, this dog that was microchipped, we found him with a broken spine, you know, 20 miles away on a highway or something.
Yeah.
Because it was just he's not domesticated really.
Right.
To me, that was a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
To me, God, you know, we were being nudged in the right direction that if we could do something, it was going to be done.
Mm-hmm.
People will listen to this. Hi, Jesse, and go, wow, circumstance. I'm not sure myself, but I just feel like, you know what? I think that everything was being done to kind of push us in the right direction that could. If we weren't going to take advantage of it, we couldn't help it.
Yeah, and I've felt that in my own life. Nudges, pushes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, clouds parting.
Guardian angels.
Yeah, it's just, you know, all of a sudden you're in the right spot at the right time, and it feels remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's something that you look at from the outside and go, it's all coincidence. But I think it's one of those things like when you read a letter that someone goes, look at this letter I just got, and you go, oh, that's really nice, and you don't know why that person's lit up from the inside. Well, it's because that letter was written right to them from somebody they really care about who understands them.
Mm-hmm.
They understand what it means more than the other people who read it and go, oh, that's great. And I think that's how it is when you can obviously believe in everything that way, and that's not right either, because we're here to make our way in the world. But I think it's that it's a personal communication, and that's why it's hard for people from the outside to really get it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like people, I do.
Like people who haven't been in love, not being able to understand what it's like to know you're in love.
Yeah, it's important. Right. It's important to know. You know, we talked about misconceptions about, you know, what Catholic Christianity means and things. A conversation that I've had a number of times with atheists or agnostics is the conversation, well, you know, how can you possibly believe that God's directing your life? And they misunderstand what that means. And I don't believe that God is moving the world around like a big chessboard. And he's making me go over here today, and he's making me go over there today.
No, we're not puppets.
We're not puppets. And that's a vital piece of the philosophy. You know, free will is absolutely vital to the entire thing. If without it, you know, it's all meaningless. You know, the Christianity would be.
Yeah, we could choose to ignore those nudgings.
Exactly. And that's the way that the communication occurs, at least the way that I feel personally, is it's nudges. You know, when you're when you're in a place where you can listen and, you know, you pay attention to those things and you act on those things, things seem to happen correctly, you know, and you end up in places where you're supposed to be. And it definitely feels remarkable, right? And you don't have to do it. They're not picking you up and moving around. Yeah,
I can't see this guy. He could have turned him away.
Right, absolutely, he could have. And it says that right in there. If I had left, you know, a minute later, or you know, he actually thought about, you know, I'm about to leave here. You know, and who hasn't done that?
The phone's
ringing. You know, it's 5 minutes to five. You're thinking, well.
Yeah.
You know, I could have left early, so maybe I'll just leave early and not answer this phone call.
Well, and I've actually had an actual true miracle that's unprovable happen, and I can send you the link so you can put it in the story because I'm not going to bother everybody with that. But it's the fact that my husband saw it first, who is the most prosaic, it's not that he doesn't believe in miracles. He doesn't go around looking for them. He's not like me. He's busy with the regular everyday life, you know. I say, wow, can you believe we were all in that corner to get that dog at the same time? And he's like, well, it is the neighborhood. I mean, he brings up everything that every normal person's going to bring up. And I think that's a healthy state of skepticism. It keeps me very grounded. But Hannah and I looked at each other and went, what are the odds? And even he says, I'm astounded that that dog was home within 40 minutes. It's unbelievable, really. Wow. He won't put it down to God, but he's just like, it's an amazing thing. Yeah, so we also don't go around believing that everything that happens is a miracle,
right?
You know,
and the devil's not
behind
too.
Every rock. You do a lot of things by your own efforts because that's part of free will. We're here to make our own way and learn and do things ourselves. Otherwise, there's no point.
Exactly.
Yeah. But definitely get this book.
People. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we should say that. I highly recommend this book. And in fact,
we didn't say much about her, but I would say that she died young. She wrote 8 books and I think this one is very, very highly regarded. It's mentioned in other people's work. But there are 2 other books that she wrote that are considered seminal mystery works. Also, the main one being The Daughter of Time.
Yeah, I went ahead and I looked on Audible, you know, to see if this existed on audio. And they have The Daughter of Time. They don't have The Franchise Affair.
No,
but The Daughter of Time, I mean, listen to this description. It's really cool.
It's one of the best books ever.
All right, cool. Confined to a hospital bed, and again, this is The Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay. Confined to a hospital bed, Scotland Yard's Inspector Alan Grant is bored. To divert his attention from his pain, a friend brings him pictures of faces. He becomes engrossed with the portrait of Richard III. How is it possible that such a sensitive-appearing soul could have been portrayed as the odious villain, the wicked uncle of history, responsible for the murder of his young nephews, heirs to the British throne, in order to secure the line of succession for himself? Grant reconsiders 500-year-old evidence pertaining to one of the most intriguing mysteries of all time. who really killed the two princes in the Tower of London? Tay's answer to this question has provoked controversy and caused this title to be ranked as the fourth best mystery of all time by the Mystery Writers of America. And just so you know, this audio version is from BBC, and it's read by Derek Jacobi. And it,
I've heard that name before.
Yeah. Let's see. Unabridged. I was looking for that word. It is unabridged. Okay. Unabridged, but it's 5 hours and 20 minutes long. So it's not a very long book.
Okay. Do they have Brat Farrar on there?
They don't have anything else by Josephine Tay, just that one. Now, one quick thing. After I finished the book last night, I poked around, you know, and I was looking for audio stuff, and I found on Radio Archive, they have a BBC radio drama of the Franchise Affair that's about 90 minutes long. And I put it on as I went to bed last night. I didn't listen to the whole thing, but it was pretty good. But again, I mean, as with most things, reading is better because it misses a whole bunch of the wit. Mm-hmm. And all these asides that I love so much about it were, you know, she says this about, you know, what about those blue eyes? Which is something we forgot to mention. But was it Marion? I'm pretty sure it was Marion who said, you know, well, that girl has those blue eyes. And those blue eyes means that you're oversexed.
and about five different people, it seemed like it bring up those blue eyes or when your eyes are like this. And okay, nobody's perfect, and I think this author had a little problem with maybe if your face looks like this, then you're like that.
Right.
And in fact, in Inspector Grant, in The Daughter of Time, he doesn't ascribe to it quite that closely, but he's looking at the faces based on his policeman's knowledge of what character shows through your face.
Interesting,
which is what starts his whole thing. He's you know, he'll look at them and go, oh, this person's like this, this, and this. Yeah. He'll turn it over and go, oh,
and that brings the whole genetic predisposition stuff up. So it's interesting, but we'll see.
But I was gonna say the other really, really well-known book, and not The Daughter of Time is the best known, but the other one that you will see mentioned in several places, and I think I left my Wikipedia printout page somewhere, I think even in Stephen King, I'm not positive, but is Brat Farrar. And that is, he's been carefully coached to assume the identity of Patrick Ashby, heir to the Ashby fortune who disappeared when he was 13. Just when it seems that Brat will pull off the deception, he discovers the truth about Patrick's disappearance, a dark secret that threatens to tear apart the family and jeopardize Brat's carefully laid plans. Called The Best of Its Kind by The New Yorker, Josephine Tay's classic is a tale of unrelenting suspense and tension, which is the Amazon description or, you know, their review.
Yeah.
But it also is probably one of the best of its kind of somebody who's taking over somebody's identity and then having to solve the mystery.
I'm so glad you introduced her to me because I want to read both of those books.
Yeah. Well, and all of her books are good. Miss Pym Disposes, I was surprised. That's held in a girls' school.
Uh-huh.
And when I was looking over her very brief history, she actually taught phys ed or gym or whatever you call it in a girls' school for a while, and that's very key to that whole mystery. And it made me think also of the mother in The Franchise Affair who had taught school and understood how kids act. I mean, you know, wasn't sentimental. And so what that made me want to do is go back and look at some of the lesser mysteries, The Singing Sands, The Man in the Queue, and look at those for, you know, more depth than I realized when I was tearing through them the first few times I read them.
Yeah.
But at some point, if you are not bringing it up, I think we will probably read The Daughter of Time if we keep going long enough.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Because it's such a great book.
Well, I'm still as excited as I was from the first episode. I'm enjoying the heck out of this. So.
Me too. I'm like, oh, what can we do next? I have these long lists of movies and books.
Yeah. And so, and speaking of next, we're going doing a quiz show.
Yes.
Is the next movie. We'll be a week into Lent because Ash Wednesday is next Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do Quiz Show, directed by Robert Redford, starring Ralph Fiennes.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Merton even makes an appearance in that movie.
Oh.
So watch for that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've never seen it. I've heard of it. It's one of those movies that, you know, is kind of mean to watch.
Yep.
But well, haven't.
I hope you like it. I sure didn't like it. And then after that, we're going to read Iffelheim by Michael Flynn. So we're going to have a little bit of science fiction, a little bit of history in there.
Medieval history, I guess.
Yep, yep. And then what's after that? Did we officially decide?
After that, I've picked, what's the movie? Stranger Than Fiction.
Oh, great. Yep.
Still be in Lent. Mm-hmm. Yes, and for anybody who's not Catholic, yes, this is how we think. It's all oriented to that, and I'm kind of stuck on the next book because I keep thinking, Easter. Oh my gosh, I don't think any of these books will work for Easter, so I may just have to go off track for that.
All right, sounds good.
Yeah, so.
All right, well, we'll see you next time in a couple weeks.
Yes, looking forward to it.
All right, bye, everybody.
Bye.